Welcome to episode 162 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, we read East of West, The Promise by Jonathan Hickman. And now, the cast begins.
So, Bomb Queen fan art is another thing that's difficult to find.
I believe that.
Just because it's all like, the fan art you can find. The fan art I can't find is the fan art that I would post on our Tumblr.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too NSFW. And it's like, there are ones that aren't, like, not, they're not like, they're not gratuitous. They're just her outfit. Like, there's just not a good angle on it that doesn't look gratuitous.
I mean, the whole point of Bomb Queen is, like, to be really inappropriate, so it's hard to find anything that, I don't know, like, I assume people who follow us on Tumblr aren't too easily offended, but, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, there's just ones that, like, with her with, like, the, like, bombs in front of her boobies, and, which is actually relatively well drawn, considering. But the rest are all just like, oh, look at how my shirt got blown apart.
I mean, it's not that surprising.
It's Bomb Queen with all of the JLA and Avengers, like, equipment.
Huh.
That one's not bad. Oh, there's nipples. There's nipples again. Ass crack, more nipples. No nipples, but her waist is skinnier than her neck. That's actually out of the comics, so that's plagiarism. More nipples. Hey, there we go, real art. Naked. 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 Naked three times.
Where are you searching?
Poorly drawn DeviantArt.
Okay, well, there we go.
I don't know where else to look for this.
For
Bomb Queen.
You could try reblogging other people's Tumblr stuff. Maybe there's someone on there.
You know, I've looked around a little bit, and I couldn't find that much, like, Bomb Queen stuff on Tumblr.
Huh. I guess Tumblr is really what's trending. It's hard to find, like, niche applications on it sometimes.
Yeah, it's a lot of the big two.
And I'm back.
There's a Bomb Queen statue?
Hello.
Oh, it's homemade. That's cool.
Oh, that is cool.
Inappropriate, but cool.
Makes you wonder what, like, that person's house looks like. Like, what's in it, aside from Bomb Queen statue?
I have a friend named Alex. Talk to him about what his dream home would look like, and then you'll know.
Wait, is this the Alex that I've met?
I think so. Rage?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rage.
Okay.
He has a large collection.
Next time I see him.
He has a large collection of figurettes that he is not allowed to take out of the closet.
Aw. You gotta express yourself. That's important too.
I'm gonna fall squarely in between him and his girlfriend on this one. You do gotta express yourself, but you know that feeling when you walk into a house and there's just like a giant, like, 2-foot by 3-foot portrait of Jesus Christ?
Yes.
It's like that same kind of awkward, but the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, I would not display things like that. Grant and I you've been to my house. You've seen the giant, like, portrait of the rooster?
Yes.
So Grant and I have argued for months over that because he says that the rooster's head looks like a vagina. And I'm like, no, it looks like a rooster. And he's like, we can't have, like, a big old pussy on the wall. And I'm like, it's just a bird.
I don't know. I was just going to say different strokes, but then I realized that might be inappropriate in context. In the context of painting, of course. I didn't want to make a pun.
Anyways.
Podcast.
You should start with Welcome to Another Alternately Futuristic
episode.
All right, everybody, welcome to another alternately futuristic episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
What's up?
Jen.
Heyo.
And it's the end of January, and just in time before it got to be February, we're starting our Best of 2013 series. And we're kicking it off with East of West by Jonathan Hickman and art by Nick Dragotta. The trade is called The Promise, and it collects the first five issues. And now this bad boy was released last year, and the trade is already out, so it's not like the shit that we pulled with Hawkeye last year. Last year we included Matt Fraction's Hawkeye, and we read for the show like 3 weeks after the last episode, or the last issue of the trade was going to be. No, you can actually go out and buy this trade. We didn't pull that shit this time. So this thing, like, for a second, when I started reading it, I like, okay, there was the whole thing with, like, the Three Horsemen, but then when it started talking about the Civil War, I realized that my knowledge of history was really, really shady, and I didn't know when it started to deviate from actual history until they were like, the armistice, and I was like, oh, yeah, that never happened.
Wow, Andy.
Well, I don't know about all of the like, the Native Americans. There might have been an endless nation. I don't know. Do you know that much about Native American tribes?
I did, in fact, know that there was no, like, single nation of Native American tribes.
I know there was no single nation, but what if there was, like, some Iroquois nation out there that named themselves the Endless Nation, but in their language that neither of us know?
No.
I mean, that's pretty nitpicky.
Right, but I'm just saying, I don't know. It could have been, I don't know, maybe.
Or how about the Golden Gate Bridge that looks like a fucking pagoda, Andy? Didn't notice that, did you?
I thought that was alternate future, because it kind of switched back and forth.
Yeah.
Maybe Andy, China invaded.
There was no Golden Gate Bridge around the Civil War time. You know that, right?
Yes.
And it didn't have pagoda roof.
You know that one. I do like the pagoda bridge, though.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Because you're just like, how can we make this look like San Francisco and China? Pagoda, bro, Golden Gate Bridge.
It's a pretty cool design, though.
It is. I like it. And it does a really good job, because the first second I saw the bridge, I'm like, okay, we're in San Francisco, China.
Now, I don't know if everybody would get that. I think we immediately got it because we live in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, well, no. It's an
iconic bridge.
It's known pretty much the world over.
Well, yeah.
Because I have family visit from India, and they want to go see the Golden Gate Bridge. I have friends visit from Boston, and they want to go see the Golden Gate Bridge. And I have family visit from Germany, and they want to go see the Golden Gate Bridge. So that covers three of the five continents. So it might not be iconic in South America or Australia or Africa. So three of the six. So half the world, at least, it's iconic.
I'm sure it is. I mean, if you think about it.
Australians know. They
everyone.
Love Full House.
Everyone also knows, like, what the Brooklyn Bridge looks like and what the Tower Bridge in London looks like.
Yeah.
Like, it's some bridges are just so famous that everyone knows them.
Okay. I'll give you that.
But they might not know what pagodas are.
That's true. They might not know the details.
They might not know that that's not what it actually looks like.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't think that's the target audience, so moot point.
But I think that does bring up something we can just talk about now. How, like, there's a lot of really cool designy visual elements in this that give this comic a really neat, distinct feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel like the last time we read something that was so visually distinct was actually another Image comic, and that's Saga. Like, the race designs in Saga, the tree spaceship, I feel like Image has been, I don't know, choosing artists, giving editorial license to artists to come up with these really creative ideas, or just hiring really good artists who have, like, these amazing imaginations, because this is really a visually satisfying comic.
I think it's probably a combination. I mean, this is essentially, I don't know if this is definitely creator-owned, but I don't think there probably isn't much editorial oversight, at least at the same degree as we would see in, like in the Big Two.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, because Jonathan Hickman is a Marvel writer. He does Avengers. And while I think his Avengers books are great and some of the best Avengers we've had in a while, and his Fantastic Four run was excellent too. This is even better, and the only reason I can think is that he probably didn't have as much editorial oversight. You know, he doesn't have to keep characters this. You know, the characters have to feel familiar, right? If you're writing Captain America, he has to feel like Captain America. Yep. He can't start acting like Wolverine or something, right? Whereas here, like, because I feel like one of Jonathan Hickman's strong points is his world building. And you can see that in Avengers, especially the Infinity crossover that they did recently. It was just this grand scale. But I think one of the things that might have happened with Infinity, it was pretty good for a crossover, but, you know, crossovers, there's always things in them that aren't great. And I think that one just got too big. And I think maybe that had something to do with, you know, Marvel editorial, because they were, like, in space, and there's Thanos, and there's, like, these two separate storylines that didn't really have anything to do with each other, and then they kind of crashed back into each other. And it was a fun read, and it was well written, but it felt too big. And you could tell that Hickman was doing, like, trying to do this world building. And here in East of West, I feel like this is excellent world building. I mean, you get a pretty good idea of what's going on just in the, maybe not what's going on, but what the world is like just in the first issue.
Yeah.
And it's excellent, you know. You know you're in the United States, or, well, you're in North America, but things are different, and you get a kind of, you get a good vibe of what the atmosphere is like, and the politics and things, just in this first issue, and it definitely is world building, you know. I mean, we get this idea of what the world is like, and, you know, as this trade goes on, we learn more about the world, but it's as the characters interact with it that we learn, you know.
Yeah, and I really like the way that the world building happens in a natural progression, the way that you see these different parts of this shattered America, how you see, like, the White Tower. They don't show it to you just to show you. They show it to you, like, here's the White Tower, and here's the president about to get fucking decapitated. and then they show you the Black Towers, which is kind of just the counterpoint. They do that a couple issues later. I think it's actually, maybe it might even just be later that same issue.
I think it's issue three or four, where we get that, actually.
And then eventually you see...
or maybe two.
Yeah, and then eventually see the House of Mao. And what's interesting is each of these have a unique feel that fits, right? Like the White Tower, White House, the Union, okay, got that. The Black Towers, right? Similar but different. And then you get the House of Mao, which is drastically different. And I feel like, okay, so this part on the West is way, way different from these two on the East that are a lot like the America that we're kind of familiar with or would expect our America to kind of go towards in some weird dystopian future. But it really makes me curious to see what the Empire of New Orleans looks like.
Yeah.
As well as the Endless Nation. Mm-hmm. I want to see what their capital is. I really, really want to see the New Orleans one, because that seems like it would be the most badass. And then what's the other one? The Texas one, too. I like the
Republic of Texas.
Yeah, and I really like, too, that these nations are... The nations are personified by the Chosen from each of them, right? So, yeah. Like, we don't have any sense of what... I don't even remember the name of the country in the South. Do you guys remember that one?
The Confederacy?
Is it just called the Confederacy in here?
Where Chamberlain's from?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just called the Confederacy.
Yeah. But, like, the only person we ever meet from there is Chamberlain. But I feel like I have such a feel for what that area is like, because he kind of is this twisted personification of the South.
You know? Like the whole Southern hospitality and even his mannerism seems like that. Not like the... Because there's, like, I feel like there's different stereotypes that come out of the South. He's not like a redneck. He's like the complete opposite.
He's like the plantation lord, yeah.
Yeah. We're not even plantation lord. He's just like a twisted Southern gentleman kind of a thing.
Yeah, I didn't want to say Colonel Sanders, because I think that's too much of a caricature.
But he's drawn like that a little bit. Yeah. And I think he's drawn like the same reason that the Golden Gate Bridge is drawn the way it's drawn. Mm-hmm. It's an immediate visual cue. You know what this guy's voice sounds like. sound like sounds yeah. like. You know, yeah. you know, just by looking at him. And I really like that visual cue, and then... But he's not Colonel Xanders. He's one of the Chosen. He's a twisted motherfucker. And I like the way that you see how his cunning comes out when he talks with Death. That's like one of my favorite scenes of this, is his talk with Death. Because yeah. he does that thing, he describes brave men. No, is it... when he's talking about, like, he does a poking, like, valiant people, and then...
Bold. He's talking about boldness.
Yeah, and it's like, but you're feigning humility, but you are being bold, talking to Death, right? And you're being so prideful and confident that you can talk your way out of it, because you're a silver-tongued guy from the South. And, like, that's what a guy from the South would be like. Like, the sense of Southern hospitality and pull you in, make you feel comfortable, make you believe in my humility, and then use that to pull you in and then get what you need from the person under the guise of the hospitality and the humility. And, like, that works so well for his character.
Yeah, and I think another great example of his character is when he talks to the other three horsemen. Mm. And, you know, he shows this, like, detached fearlessness, you know. It's like he has apathy for the whole situation, and I think that kind of, even these big characters like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, it probably puts them on edge, because they're these entities to be feared, right? And he seems to not even care.
Yeah, doesn't even give a fuck.
And then by the end of the fight, like after reading issue 2 where he talks to Beth, I thought, okay, this guy's gonna betray the other Chosen. But then we see him, I still kind of get the feeling that he's going to betray them for his own ends, but by the end of issue 5, I don't know where he stands. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially after he talks to, what's the guy from Texas, Bell?
Bell Solomon.
After that discussion, you're like, he is playing. He wants to play both sides. It's a game to him. And I like that that ties back into his being a personification of the South. Like, you get that image of the plantation owners sitting there playing chess. Or sitting there playing... What do they play in the South? Backgammon? I don't know.
No idea.
But I get an image of him sitting in some Victorian building's parlor playing some fucking table/card game or whatever. I get that image out of him when he talks about it being a game and there being pieces. You know? And it's like, of course it's a game to him. But then... And when he's having the discussion with Bell, Bell doesn't have any of that. Bell's like, no, we have to do what's just and what's right. And he was like, I just kind of went with this to see what they were doing, but now I think they're actually going to do it, and I have to stop them. And I kind of like that coming from Texas too, because Texas is kind of a state of that they will do what's right and they don't give a fuck. Like, back when they wanted to be their own fucking country, they were like, I don't want to take a side in this. Fuck you guys.
But it's interesting, too, because you kind of get the sense that Bell Solomon's not going to come out of this okay, whereas Chamberlain, I mean, if we follow all the tropes, he's going to get his comeuppance, but there's also a really good chance that he's going to come out on top here, because he knows how to play all the cards. Oh, I was just going to say, like, that's kind of something, I think, a Texas stereotype is like that brashness, too, where you just kind of do the thing and worry about the consequences later, whereas Chamberlain, he's more, like, planning for the long term.
Yeah, I feel like even if he doesn't come out on top in the end, he's going to be in this game until the end. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I kind of get the Eddard Stark thing from Bell Solomon.
he's just
gonna get fucked up in this. And then I also like the way that if you're gonna have the Union in this, you can't have a president that has his own background. I kind of like that they went off and they had Death kill that president, and then they just kind of moved down the line until they found somebody who would be a pawn for the Horsemen, because that president would be the one that we would immediately identify with.
Yeah.
Regardless of what they were like, they were going to be like, that's the Union. The Union won. We are part of the Union. That's my guy. I'm rooting for him. Right? Like, there'd be that immediate slant that way. But I like how Hickman just was like, nope, you don't get that here. That guy is dead. because Death killed him, and that's what Death does. And now, in place is a pawn. And I like that the way that counterpoints to Zhaolin in what's the name of the Chinese country?
It's called the PRA.
The PRA, yeah. The People's Republic of America, I think.
Yeah, she's the House of Mao.
The House of Mao. Yeah. She's the leader of the House of Mao. I like the way that she's the foil for the American president.
Also, I want to point out, like, remember how they went through the entire freaking staff, and someone did offer to be a pawn, and he was like, "I'll just do anything you want, don't kill me." And they said, "No, we need someone who understands the message.
We need a believer."
Yeah, someone who really is on their side in this. And that's even scarier, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like Andy said, you wouldn't want the readers to associate or identify with an American, like somebody who is analog to the president, right? So they picked this character who is like, you know, she doesn't look anything. She doesn't look like she should be a politician at all.
She looks like a...
She's like a witch or something.
What's the woman from, not Adam's Family, the other one, from the Munsters? What was the wife in that one? I don't know. It looks like her.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's actually really strange because I would think if I just had to look at her and place her in one of the groups, I'd say House of Mao, maybe. Because she looks kind of mysterious and very feminine. Yeah. I don't know.
She has like a... She looks kind of evil, you know?
Yeah.
A little, yeah.
I mean, the gray stripes in her hair and this weird gown thing. She looks like a wizard or something, you know? She doesn't look like the president.
Yeah. But I think what we're getting to is that there's really, really good character design in this comic, which is important because these characters just carry this, both in the way that they're personifications of the country, but also the people who aren't necessarily attached to a country. Like, Death's character design is so good.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we see him in some flashbacks, and he's black, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's our protagonist, and he's white.
Yes. I love that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting choice because the color white is always associated with, not always, but generally speaking, it's associated with goodness and purity and the good guys, right?
Yeah, he's wearing a white hat in a Western. He is.
Yeah, he's literally the white hat, and he was previously a black hat, right? It's subtle and heavy-handed at the same time.
But it's,
you know, in Chinese culture and Japanese culture, white is the color of death, and it seems like he made this change after he ended up with Zhao Lian.
That's interesting.
So I'm wondering if that was like her influence.
See,
I can see that point of view. Sorry, Andy, can I just finish?
Yeah.
She is surprised at what he looks like when she sees him again.
Yes.
And because not just the color change.
The last time she saw him, he was the death from flashbacks, the black hat, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he did it as some kind of memory to her. Or as some kind of memorial, I guess. That's what I'm trying to say.
And also, she says, oh, God damn it, go.
Sorry, we keep, like, starting at the same time. Just, did you notice the other horseman gender swapped? And he didn't. He stayed male. And he didn't actually die, where it sounds like they may have just been reborn.
Yeah, I think they were reborn. They died.
Everyone went through some sort of change there. Just side note.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think the change for him in colors, I don't know if it is white hat versus black hat, necessarily, like, good versus bad.
No, I don't think so either.
No, and I don't know if it's necessarily related to Zhaolin's death. I think it's more related to his being betrayed. Because we get the scenes with the hunter, right? We get the two-panel flashbacks that he has of them looking down on him. And when he sees himself in those flashbacks, he's black. And then everything after that, he's white. I think it's the betrayal by the other three horsemen that makes him change. And when she comments on his change in appearance, I don't necessarily that she calls... I don't think that she comments on the white versus black. If I recall, she says that he looks older, or looks aged, or looks tired, or something along those lines. Mm. And I think... I don't know. I think it's more... Not necessarily the idea of transformation, but maybe being burned out. He's more the color of ash now than he would have been before.
Hmm.
Like, it's not necessarily just a change. It's that he's changed in purpose in a way that's not for the better. And in a way that's slowly destroying him and slowly changing who he is in a way that love did, but the opposite. Because he didn't change colors when he was with Zhao Lian. Because I feel like that would have done something too, because that's in the message how he changes for her.
Right.
I'm done now. That's all I wanted to say.
That was a really good point. Like, that's interesting. Like, I mean, he did mention what he had to sacrifice a lot to be where he is now, and it makes you wonder, like, you know, how that's related. I think it's just more of that world building too.
Yeah.
You know, finding out what's actually happening.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was betrayed in more ways than one, right? They drew him away from her, stole the baby, and took her hands and then imprisoned her, right? And they at least the Chosen thought that they had killed him. So he had to do something to not die.
Yeah.
And so something he paid dearly for that is what he said, right? To stay.
Yeah. It makes
And I think the reason he stayed was for revenge.
Or he but does then, actually say, like, there's no way they would have killed the son.
Right, because he's he's the beast of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they need him. They feel like they cherish him. But do the other three horsemen, is rebirth part of their natural cycle? How long was war, say, just picking out war, a woman? War doesn't look old. Death looks old. But war didn't look old in flashbacks. War doesn't look old now. None of them looked older before. And so I'm wondering if the reason he changes and the reason he looks old is because he didn't die. If that death and rebirth is a cycle for them. And it is, I think, because they talk about having been reborn before. Mm-hmm. And how some of them don't like it and some of them do.
Well, so the horsemen have something to do with the message, right?
Yes.
And they didn't hear about... There was no the message until after this comet impact.
Oh, and yeah. So it does correlate.
Do we know if the... I mean, we don't know if the horsemen were around before the comet impact or the creation of the message. But Conquest does say to the tracker that... he's 1,500 years old when he tells him that he wants a drink, and he says, "Aren't you a little young?" And he says something like about how he's 1,500 years old. Hmm. Let's see if I can find that line again. So this is the year 2064, right?
Yes.
So 1,500 years before that would be like 500 AD-ish.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Maybe he's just making up a number.
Yeah, he could be.
I think he's just throwing a number out there that's going to sound big and impressive. Because it feels like a random date. 1564. Did anything happen in 1564? Let me Google that. 1564. I'm going to feel terrible if it's like an important year. Like the day the Civil War began.
No, Andy, that's 1861. There was no America. Well, no, it's not 1564. It's 564 AD.
Oh, yeah. Okay, hold on. 564. 564. Let me put it in here.
I don't think it is anything.
It was a leap year starting on Tuesday.
Great.
No, I don't see anything in Wikipedia anywhere that makes me think that this year is anything important.
No, I think you're right. I think it's just... he probably just pulled out a random date. But I guess what I'm curious about is these are like ancient entities, right? I mean, at least that's the notion that I get from them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, were they around? were they around before the message? Maybe the message was like the beginning of the end, and then maybe the apocalypse was supposed to come sooner, and then Death basically left his post when he fell in love, right?
Yeah.
And so then something happened and they died. And now they've come back to try again, but Death is still, you know, they seem to be, they were surprised that Death wasn't there because they thought they had killed him. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We'll probably have to, I'm sure this, maybe it's irrelevant, or maybe it'll come up, you know, if we keep reading, it'll come up in the story, right?
You know, the more we talk about this, the more I realized how much I just kind of read over in the first issue. I was like, okay, that's probably going to be a thing for later, but I just kind of needed to plow through all of this, like, dense stuff in the beginning to get to the story, at which point all of this will make sense. And now that we're talking about it, it does make sense.
Well, the funny thing is, right, like, this is a comic I get this monthly, and I reread issue number one. I reread the five issues, right?
Yeah.
For the podcast, and I didn't realize that the message had actually been recited. And I have been, like, I've been reading, I think they're on issue 8 now, and I've been like, when are we going to find out what the message is? And it's in issue 1. So I feel like really stupid. But no, I mean, I'm glad I figured that out now.
But they haven't told us all of the message, just snippets. So, I mean, there is a lot more to learn.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, yeah, I found the place where Conquest is talking to the tracker. He doesn't say...
Specifically.
He doesn't say a number. I don't remember where I read that 1,500 years. But he actually says, oh, I'm ancient, older than the world, so...
Oh, okay. So nothing special about 564.
Yeah, I don't know where that number came up.
That makes me wonder... how much this is tied to the original, like, Bible mythology around it. Because I think in my very limited knowledge of the Book of Revelations, doesn't, like, Jesus unleash 4 of the 7 seals calling down the horsemen from, I think it was the side of God?
I have no idea.
Or something. So it's like...
I haven't read my Bible in a long time.
I think the horsemen in the original myth are, like, newer than Jesus, at least in their incarnations on Earth. So I wonder, like, if any of that's going to play into this.
Well, in the Bible, everything's older than Jesus, because Jesus is a part of God. Right. I mean, what... It's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Trinity are all one. So Jesus is a part of God, and God is a part of Jesus. Like, it's like an avatar. Think of it as God's avatar.
Getting, right? Like, now, multicultural in this.
Now, not in the like, Legend of Korra sense.
In the Hindu sense, right?
No, not even the Hindu sense. Like, an avatar is just, like, a representation of a spiritual idea.
But, I mean, we know that it was, like, in Jesus... Or we know, I say this as though I know this. the Bible states that it was, like, Jesus's physical manifestation on Earth or some point after that did this thing, so...
Yeah. So, I mean, by necessity, according to the Bible, everything's older than Jesus. But, I mean, it's here nor there.
We're getting, like, philosophical up in here.
Okay, Jen, so you are right. It is the Lamb, referring to Jesus, because it's capital L, Lamb, opened the 7 seals, the first 4 of the 7 seals, and it released conquest, war, famine, and then death. Well, so it's interesting. So they're described as by their horses in the Book of Revelations.
Mm-hmm.
So death is actually described as... you know, he arrives on a pale horse.
Hmm.
And so now he's pale, right? He was black before, and now he's... I mean, it's kind of... Pale, to me, is like white, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's also been interpreted as sickly. But that's neither here nor there, because his actual horse is a cannon. Fucking
badass.
Yes. Can we take a minute to just, like, appreciate that fucking horse? Because that thing is amazing.
See, for a while I was like, that thing's so weird looking. That thing's stupid. That's so dumb. And then it fucking fired a blast out of its face. And I'm like, you yes.
You thought it was dumb? I didn't think it was dumb.
I thought it was super cool.
Okay, you know what? I was like... When I saw it, I was like, okay, I can understand how that idea sounds neat, but you're trying way too hard to make this look like Old Westy when you have, like, there are ships flying around all the time in this. Why does this horse thing need robotic legs? Why wouldn't he just have, like, a swoop or a scouting bike? Or, like, why wouldn't he have, like, a land speeder? Why does it have to have legs? Not like, it doesn't the... make...
It it's doesn't not make... the four land speeder men of the apocalypse.
We're so random. Okay, the other three don't travel around on any kind of horse.
As far not as you know.
Seen, we haven't have we seen them traveling yet? I don't know, Andy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's just
they're like, only kids, maybe they're too small for horses.
For a long time I was like, you're just trying too hard to make this thing like a horse western-y kind of guy, like
Andy, I think when they made Death a cowboy, they stopped needing to try hard to make it a Western.
No, exactly. That's why I felt like it was, you don't need to do this. This horse doesn't need to look like his ride doesn't need to have four legs that run like a horse. It doesn't need that. You've already achieved, like, faux Western alternate future. This feels good. The vibe is great. And this, at this point, is just, like, it's too much. But, like I said, I felt that way until the face turned out to be a cannon. And I was like, all in now, because it can run around on its own and shoot like a fucking cannon. And that is awesome.
So when it stopped being a robotic, like, motorcycle with legs and became a robot, you liked it?
Exactly. Motorcycle with legs is great. Why not just have a motorcycle? Why does it have to have legs? We're even have better than that now.
People like horses.
I know, but when it was a motorcycle with legs, it seemed stupid. But then when it was a robot, it was cool. You phrased exactly my feeling, even though you're trying to be mocking. robots are cool, and motorcycles don't need legs.
I think we spent too much time on this.
So, okay, the last character that we mentioned, but didn't talk about, but is super important for this, is Xiao Lian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She's fucking awesome.
She is quite the badass.
And I like that in the end, she kicks Death out. She's like, you fucking get the fuck out of here.
I mean, it's his wife. And she said, go get our son. And he's like, yes, ma'am.
I mean, I think she has a right to be pissed.
Yeah.
So I far. Mean, we don't know because we don't know what was so pressing that he had to leave. But
even he owns up to her. He says, you're right. I should have been there. He's like... The reason I was gone wasn't worth it. In retrospect, like, you're right. He owns up to it, and I like that he owns up to it. But I like that she has the balls to tell Death after fucking taking down her entire empire, basically, her father's empire. Tells him, no, bro. I know they were husband and wife, so, like,
well, even more than that, on a prophetic, like, philosophical level... She is the woman who conquered Death, right?
Yeah.
She stared him in the face. We get the flashback where she, the day she killed 100 men, and she becomes a war master, and she looks Death in the face as she's about to decapitate that guy, and she says, fuck you, Death, and she doesn't kill him.
Yeah.
So she conquered Death, and then there's so many cool, like, quotes in here. I can't remember which one it was.
The one Lotus about, who didn't know mercy and found mercy, but not for mercy's sake.
No. The one where she says something about love and the resurrection. I forget. Damn it, I should have wrote it down.
It's fine. It's not like we have notes or anything, David.
I know. Shut up. I never write in the notes.
I know you don't. It's good. It makes us feel kind of improvised.
I feel like I do a pretty good job. Now we're getting too meta. We're talking about the podcast now. Anyways, it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, it matters, but Anyways.
What were we talking about? So
we're talking about Zhao Lin and how she's cool.
Yes. And I think part of the reason that she really, really works in this comic is the quality of the art and how well her subtle facial expressions are conveyed through the art. So much, her personality for so much of this is quiet and calm and in control. And when you have a character that's like that, the facial expressions and her mannerisms become super important. And if Nick Dragotta had nailed them, this character wouldn't have come off nearly as well. But he does such a good job of, like, that subtle smile, that subtle look, the subtle little this. And then when she gets angry and she just, when there's no subtlety on her face, when she loses it with, when she grabs the sword and smashes her sister's head, right? Like, oh, shit. Like, you get so much out of her just from her facial expressions. And that's part of, I think, the way her character works so well. And I can't say, I don't have anywhere near enough experience about Chinese culture to say how that might or might not be a part of the personification of the country in which she's supposed to embody. I have no idea. But I feel like Mao was a little bit okay. So this is a chairman, they're communist. I get that. It's cool. But like her and the cultural things that she embodies, we were kind of able to talk about Chamberlain and the way he embodies the cultural vibe of the South. I don't know enough about Chinese culture to say how she might or might not embody that cultural vibe. I have no idea. Either way, she's fucking badass and I love her. I can see why Death loves her.
She also, I think one of the best lines in this trade applies to her too, where after they cut off her hands, it says something like, you know, Zhao Lian Mao knew that begging was below her. And then as she groveled in the dirt, you know, she decided that she should also beg. And, you know, she begged for the life of her son, but they showed no mercy. And I think just like that little line shows so much about who she is. Like, she is so proud. And then it's like just a few words and it tells you exactly how important her son is to her. And that's a really, like, elegant way of summarizing a character. You know, someone who is just far too proud to be begging and is anyway, because this thing is so important. It just, I think, sums her up really nicely. That's why I like the writing in this story. It's so good.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Well, I think that's the point. I think I was trying to say something similar to that about how there are these little quotes that seem, for lack of a better word, biblical. I mean, they're not from the Bible, but they have that kind of weight and tone to them.
Yeah.
And that really, it communicates a lot. It's very good economy of words. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that really adds weight to this whole comic. Do you know what I mean? There's just something there. You can tell that there's a lot under the surface, and you just have to keep going through the story until you figure out when the pieces all fall into place. I feel like you as a reader will be greatly rewarded for your patience. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. And I think that patience is actually one of the only frustrating parts about this, where, like, we talked a little earlier about the world building, and how it's very expansive, but when you're starting out, especially in maybe the first two issues, I feel like it's also a little hard to grasp the scale of this story. For instance, you know, how old are the horsemen? When did they discover that death was no longer one of the four? And how does this take place in, like, relative to the other things we see? And I'm sure that's all going to get filled out, because this seems like it's being very skillfully done. But it's a lot to swallow in five issues. So I think this is something where you do need to decide, like, I'm going to follow it through. And that's what's going to give the best experience.
Especially that first part of the first issue is so dense. When they're telling you the message before you get to the point with death in the bar.
Yeah.
Like, once you get to death in the bar, it all moves along at a pace that you're fine with. Or that I'm fine with, at least. It's like, okay, now we're telling the story. Before that, it's a whole lot of really dense world building in a way that I really like, because it seems like you use the word prophetic, David. Like, that's a great word. It feels like, oh, cool. And it makes me feel like, all right, come issue 10 or 12, I'm going to want to go back and reread this first issue and be like, what did I not get in these first couple pages that they already knew they were going to talk about that I just didn't fill in? And, like, we were talking about how earlier you mentioned something like how when they awoke, they were upset that the first one wasn't there because that's when they found out that he didn't die. And, like, I hadn't put that together until you said it. That's why, because I had forgotten about that scene because I just kind of read over it, waiting to get to the part that was like, okay, and now I can just read this without being like, what the fuck did they mean by a cup is a cup? Or no, a cup of a cup.
And a chalice of a chalice.
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck did they mean here? I don't fuck, fuck this. I'm just going to keep reading. What's the next text box say? Lotus, this. Okay, great. You know, and it's all really heavy and prophetic and cool sounding, but as a reader, you're like, I don't know what the fuck any of this is.
Well, see, sometimes there are lesser comics where the writer will use things like that. Yeah. Like quotes from Shakespeare or the Bible or whatever. Oh, and it
pretentious and fuck.
Exactly. It just comes off as pretentious. And so I think it's easy to write that kind of thing off when you're reading a comic, because a lot of times it's complete fucking bullshit, right? But here, it's like, you'll read a comic and it'll have a quote from the Bible, and you'll be reading something like Spawn, right? And you're like, who the fuck? Somebody just put this in here because this quote says the word hell, and then Spawn's from hell, and they really have nothing to do with each other, and it just comes off as pretentious. But here, this is all coming out of John Hickman's head, you know? It all has relevance.
And but, like I said, everything follows the message.
Yeah, and I don't think you're wrong for glossing over it, because that's, you know, you read enough comics and you kind of get trained. Everybody has their way of reading comics, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that you always do this when you read comics, because I don't know if you do. But sometimes the stuff in the little squares doesn't matter.
Yeah, I hardly ever read the words in comics. I just like the pictures.
I'm like the opposite. I read the words and often don't pay attention to the art.
I just look at the boobies and turn to the next page and look at more boobies.
Yep.
I don't know. But that said, because the first couple pages are so like grandiose and prophetic, we get this really great art out of those pages too. Mm-hmm. And I think, as much as at least I talked about how much I appreciated the work on the faces in this comic, at least as it pertained to Zhao Lian and her character building, what I appreciate most about the art in this comic is the really, really good full pagers.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's
like, even when I stopped reading the fifth one, and we get that really good full pager of Death walking off into the sunset.
Oh, that's with my favorite.
The crows
favorite.
And the wolves. I love that one. But my favorite is you're in the desert and there's those pillars and there's like the three like intertwining columns of smoke coming up after they've been reborn. Mm-hmm. And there's just like stars all over as the like smoke comes up. Like that page, I can still visualize it in my head so well. I can see it so vividly. Mm-hmm. That page was so well drawn, just so simple and elegant, but at the same time, really prophetic. Like, this is them out in the desert. Nobody knows they're getting reborn. It's sort of this little private moment between the three of them, but everything's going to be about these three and they're being reborn. And, like, it just gets it all. And it's drawn so wonderfully.
Yeah. Speaking of the art, Nick Dragota actually made an appearance at my local comic book shop.
I'm so pissed now I didn't go to that.
Yeah, me too. Like, I couldn't make it for some reason, and I'm so mad. Because I was already reading this when he... You know, this had been out for a few issues by the time he came to our shop, and I was pretty sad when I couldn't make it. Hopefully he will come back to our comic book shop, because...
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. He's awesome. His artwork is amazing. I don't know if I've read anything else with him.
This is the first time I've ever heard his name. I feel kind of bad because there are so many good artists out there. Like, I look on Tumblr, right? Not Tumblr. Like, well, yeah, Tumblr and DeviantArt, and there's so many awesome pieces from artists I've never heard of. And it feels like I think a lot of the writers get all this big-name billing, you know, nowadays. Whereas, in times past, it used to be the artist was the first name on a comic.
Yeah.
And now it's the writer. And I feel like the writer's names we get, but a lot of times the artist kind of gets forgotten. And man, shouldn't be. I'm reading this, I'm like, this guy's good. And he's good in a way that you can tell he's probably been good for a while. Like, how have I never heard of Nick Dragotta before? I was like a little bit upset by the time I was done reading this. I was like, how have I not heard of this man before?
I had the same reaction. I was like, why don't I know this name? Because we've read a lot of comics, and this is really good art. Like, I want this sort of thing, like, in a coffee table book, you know? And, like, how did I not know?
Do all of these end in full page art? I think they do.
I don't recall.
I'm scrolling through. Okay, the last one ends with him on a horse riding into the sunset. Number four ends with Death bowing before Zhao Lian, which is awesome. Except the weird walking motorcycle doesn't. The third one ends with Death on his walking motorcycle looking down at the Herald. The Mao's like guy who ran out there and
that was an awesome full pager too.
That one is with him up there on the white in his white thing on the horse.
Yeah.
What was issue two's last page? Let me see. The end of issue two is not a full pager.
Oh.
It ends with Zhao Lian in her collar.
Oh yeah, our first look at her.
The top has a couple scenes with Chamberlain and Death on it.
Issue one ends in a full pager though.
So what were they screwing up with issue two? What the
heck? Cut them some slack.
I will. Slack has been cut. No, issue one doesn't end with a full pager.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. I'm looking at it right now.
It ends with him walking out of the... after blowing the president's head off.
Oh, wait. No, I'm not looking at the right page.
That explains it.
Yep, you're right. It does. Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah, you should be.
So what... Okay, so what was your guys' favorite scenes in this? I think I talked about mine. Yeah, my favorite written scene is when Death talks to Chamberlain. My favorite drawn scene is the one with the columns and the art and the wispy stuff. What about you guys? What was your favorite scene?
So I already talked about my favorite written scene where Zhao Lian grovels for her son. But my favorite... visual scene also involves her, and it's where Mao asks her, so was it worth it? And she just, like, has this smirk on her face that is so good. Like, it's this clever, like, catty smile. And she's like, yes. You know, he's surprised by that answer because, like, so much crap has happened to her because of this. And it's just that you see her spirit in that and how strong she is and that she has no problems dicking with her father, even though, you know, he's the one in power here. So I really love that panel.
David?
Well, like I said, for the art ones, I really liked the final page of issue 5.
Oh,
where
yeah.
With them
into the sunset.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And the end of issue 3, where he's on his horse in front of the Herald, those are just awesome scenes. As far as the written parts go, I really like actually the first bar scene where the tracker, when he realizes who he's talking to.
Yeah,
I think that really does a good job of setting the tone for Death. You know, how at least how he's viewed. You know, how he's viewed by the people who know who he is and are not on his side of the line. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It does an excellent job of setting the tone for the comic, I think. I really like that. The whole interaction there was great. The way that Hickman and Dragotta use flashbacks in this is awesome.
Yes.
Because it's always when a person realizes who they're talking to, and then there's a flashback, and then you're like, and their facial expression completely changes.
And I like the way that they weave it throughout the story, because you get that one scene of them looking down on death from being up on something, right? You get that one scene, and then it keeps coming back. So you see the first time with the tracker, right? And then again when Death confronts the president of the union, mm-hmm. you get the big scene, and then you get the close-up of him in that scene. And you're like, okay, that's why that guy is getting fucked, because he is there, and that was him.
One thing that I just noticed, I'm looking at the flashback scene in issue one, where we see the trackers in the center, and then on the second panel down below, it's Death surrounded by the other three horsemen. In the ship above the tracker and the president and stuff, there's a window, and there's a silhouette of somebody standing in the window, but you can't see who it is. I want to know who that person is.
Yeah, he's real fucked.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's must be the orchestra, the puppet master, I feel like he's the big bad.
Which ones do we not see in this scene? You get the tracker up front, the president to the right,
it looks like Chamberlain on the far left.
Chamberlain on the far mm-hmm. left. The PRA security advisor daughter.
Who?
Into the middle to the left. The PRA. Yeah, who? Oh, yeah,
who?
Yeah, sorry.
Her name is who? Who's on first?
Yeah. And then, yeah, the far right is the Endless Nation.
Yeah, and there's somebody above them. So the nations that are not obviously represented here are
Texas
and the Kingdom.
And the Kingdom of New Orleans. I fucking love that so much, the Kingdom of New Orleans. Yeah. I wanna see it so bad.
But somehow I don't think it's one of them.
No.
Mm-mm.
Could it be the guy from Armistice? No, he seems like a total tool. He wouldn't do something like this.
Well, he seems like some kind of religious figure almost. Yeah. Like
he's
a clergyman.
He's not an orchestrator. Yeah, I don't know. Whoever that is.
He's a lackey.
Yeah, exactly. But whoever that is up there, he's real fucked.
Yeah. It's not going to end well for him.
Well, Death is going to kill him extra hard, right?
I mean, you know what I love about this, though? Is the way they talk about Death as being inevitable. And how Death comes for everyone. Those kinds of sayings that people say. And it's like, yeah, doesn't matter how you position yourself as a chosen. Doesn't even matter how you position yourself as one of the horsemen. The horsemen are reborn. Something has to happen to them before they get reborn. What could that be? Maybe they have to die.
Well, what's interesting, though, is like we see the inevitability of death coming. But the only person who that's not Death that comes out and says it is the Chamberlain. And yeah. Death is, he, like, appreciates that sentiment. He even says, inevitable, I like that.
Yeah. Because he knows it. He knows he is.
Yeah.
And I like the way that there's a thing about him where he makes people say his name, his real name. He makes them call him Death. Ah, so good. I like him even though he's so terrifying.
Well, I mean, we're supposed to like him. He's the protagonist, right?
Yeah.
But... I guess I should say that Jonathan Hickman did a really, really good job of making the concept of death into a personified protagonist. That takes some doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been nailed.
Well, yeah. The thing is, I mean, I think we know that he is an evil character because the Grim Reaper or Death or a Horseman of the Apocalypse is an evil idea, evil concept, right? But Hickman, like you said, Andy, Hickman does a great job personifying Death, but he also does a really good job of setting the characters that are around Death to be more evil than he is.
Yeah. Yeah, Conquest, Feminine War are real fucked up.
Well, you're right, them too, but what I was referring to was the Chosen. They are some fucked up individuals. At least the ones that we spend some time with. Maybe not Bell Solomon from Texas. He seems like he is trying to right his wrong. But people like Chamberlain and... Well, Chamberlain's probably the best example of being one evil motherfucker. Yeah. But yeah, and maybe the new Madam President, she seems kind of evil, but we don't really get much of her in these first five issues.
I love it. She turns out to be like the hero of the story. She ends up being the editor of the story. But I think Bell, more than anybody, he's going to be the figure who's going to be like, it's great that you now see the wrong of your ways, now that the game has already mostly been played and it's inevitable anyway, mm-hmm. but you already went too far down this road to make up for it. Like, he is at that chamber where they are fucking with Death's kid, and he probably had some hand in making sure that that happened. And he can see that it's wrong now, but brother, you already helped build it.
Yep.
You already committed those sins. You already dug that grave. I'm sorry, buddy. There's only so much you're going to be able to backtrack from that.
Well, I think
it's
going
to be fun to see what happens to him.
I think he has accepted the inevitability of his situation, but I think he's trying to go out on...
go out on a high note?
A high note, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or at least he's going to go out on the right side of... At least on... Or the good side, you know...
Yeah, he wants to die a good person.
Yeah, with a clear conscience. Well, not a clear conscience, but...
But some sense of repentance coming forth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Making up for his wrongs, yeah. That kind of noble sentiment.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You guys ready to rate this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jen, you go first.
I'm going to give this a 4.5. I think that if I continue reading this story, that's actually going to develop into a 5 unless things start going very differently. It's just, as it stands, the universe is still being built for me, and the story is still not complete enough for me to know where it's going. That doesn't mean it's, like, that's a negative. That's perfectly fine. But I don't have that, like, little, you know, back of the mind feeling like, oh, this is the best thing ever. It has to be a 5. So I am really excited to keep reading this. I think the art's beautiful. I think the story is well executed so far and that it's going to continue to be so because I can't see it going down in quality. Like, I think that they have built themselves a really good premise, and if they just follow that through, it's going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, 4.5.
All right. David, how about you?
I am also going to give this a 4.5. I totally agree with Jen's statements on the quality of this work. I mean, I found... Where I will disagree with Jen is, but this is purely my opinion, is I don't find the lack of completion in the world building to be a negative. I'm not saying that you made it, you're saying it's a negative, Jen, but like I like the fact that I feel like we got a lot, but there's a lot more to go, and that makes me want to keep up with this. Like, I really want to know what's going on here, and I don't think that feeding it to us slowly is a negative. I think that's a positive for keeping readers engaged. But yeah, I think that the character development, the world building are excellent. The art is damn near perfect. This is such a good comic. I can see why this is considered one of the best of last year. So easily it's 4.5. And like Jen, I can imagine myself continuing to read. I mean, I have read issues past this, but I'm trying to just rate these first five. This is definitely a worthy, if not a 4.5, it's a 5. You know, it's right on the cusp.
Well, don't worry about the cusp because I'm dropping a 5 on it.
Nice.
I really like this. I think the kicker for me is how good the art is and how upset I am with myself for not having heard of this guy's name and for not going to the fucking signing when he was here. He was, like, at our local comic shop, the one that we go to every month.
Yeah.
I could have had him sign that page that I love. Ah, ball sack.
This is going to upset you even more, Andy. They had issues, I think copies of number one, with blank covers, just the title. And so he was drawing... things right on the cover for people.
Oh.
I was seething over here. I'm seething. My own anger at myself.
Hey, I missed out too, so I feel your pain, buddy.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the art's just so good. And as you guys were talking about the world building and how it's moving a little bit slow, I was like, there are times when slow-moving world building makes me go, okay, but just tell me already. And I think those are the times when the world building is good. But I don't necessarily trust that it's all going to be done really well. So I want to see it now before I lose faith in the comic. Or I just want to see it now because I just want to see it now because I like it and I just want to see it. But I have enough trust and faith in Jonathan Hickman and Nick Dragotta based on what they've shown me of Chamberlain and Solomon and the House of Mao. I have enough trust in the way that they pulled off these other three nations that I believe that once I finally see the Kingdom of New Orleans, I'm going to love it just as much as I love these other ones. And so the story hasn't moved there naturally yet. There's no reason for me to have seen it yet. I can't wait to see it, but it'll come when it comes. So I guess using the phrase "I can't wait to see it" isn't appropriate because I'm feel perfectly confident, comfortable waiting to see it. Roundabout way of saying that, I know it's gonna happen, and I know it's gonna be done well. We're gonna get there in a way that's natural, and I'm gonna love every minute of my time in the Kingdom of New Orleans and the Endless Nation.
I love that you're so fixated on this Kingdom of New Orleans.
I don't know why. It seems so perfect to me because of the whole French thing and New Orleans. Of course New Orleans would have a fucking kingdom. Like, it just it makes...
No, it's cool.
That's the whole thing. It makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And it's just... because it makes perfect sense, I know it's going to be great. And because it's so rare that I have that kind of confidence in the ability of a writer and an artist, especially working together the way that these two work together so well, that's so rare to find in a comic. I can't not give this a 5. So yeah, 5.
Awesome.
A wonderful way to start off our best of 2013. But next week we're going to follow up that best of 2013 with a title from one of the big two, which I think is like almost obligatory in the best of. I think last year we had one. It was Hawkeye, and this year we have one. And next week, this year has to be a DC one. I feel so bad for DC; they never make it onto the best of lists.
maybe next year's their year because I mean, it started in 2013, but Forever Evil is an excellent comic.
Wait, or did we do we? I think we did Court of Owls
as part. We did Batman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Now I don't feel too bad. So anyway, next week though is Superior Spider-Man, My Own Worst Enemy, by Dan Slott. It's collecting issues 1-5. This one, I especially wanted to put on here because it was on a lot of best of lists, even though when the premise for it first came out, it was really just derided all over the internet. People thought it was the dumbest thing. I saw so many people saying how they were going to stop reading Spider-Man, how they were going to move away from Marvel because this was just the dumbest thing ever. And then by the end of the year, anybody who read it was like, it's actually pretty fucking good, guys. So I can't wait to see it, because I was one of those people who said this was fucking stupid. But
I was too, and I already picked up my copy of the trade, and yeah, I like this one. And I kind of wish I'd picked up the hardback, actually, because if you guys haven't picked up your copy yet, consider getting Superior Spider-Man. It's just called Superior Spider-Man Volume 1. It doesn't have the My Own Worst Enemy subtitle. Because that has issues 698 through 700 of Amazing Spider-Man, which was the end of that run before it's transitioned to Superior Spider-Man. Nice. And so they're in the hardback version.
Oh, thanks for that pro tip. Now I know which one to buy.
And it's also issues, it has 698 to 700 and then 1-5 of Superior Spider-Man. And it's a good looking hardback. I'll admit it, I just cheaped out and didn't buy it, and now I wish I had.
Well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
So that's next week. If you want to know what we have coming up after that, go to our website, www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. And if I haven't been too lazy, when you click on that button on the right that says future shows or upcoming shows, I don't even remember what it says. If you click on it, there's a big arrow to the right. If you click on it, it'll have a list of what we have coming up over the next couple of months, so you can read with us. If you think we could have picked better things to read for the best of 2013, or if you already have a recommendation for best of 2014, or you just want to have us read anything, shoot us an email and let us know at
atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
And as always, follow us on the social media stuff, facebook.com/APSupercast, twitter.com/APSupercast, and apsupercast.tumblr.com. We post art, cool things. I reblog stuff. It's neat.
Yeah, stuff that we find entertaining. And if there's posts about kaiju and monster movies, that's me reblogging. Just so
you know. And I reblog this weird thing with what's the mushroom guy from Mario?
Toad.
Yeah, I reblogged this gif of Toad just wigging the fuck out, and it just made me laugh for 10 minutes when I saw it, and I couldn't help but reblog it. So that's the kind of random shit you get on Tumblr. Just go ahead and follow it. It's neat. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yeah! Welcome to 2014, everybody. I feel so good doing the best of 2013. I love it. All right.
Yeah, and I feel like this was a great episode and a great comic that deserved a great episode, so yeah. I'm glad this one went well. Yeah, excellent.
All right, everybody. Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.